evening and good afternoon on this, I'll say blistery hot summer day. But it's, I mean, it's gorgeous outside. I don't know about you, PA, but I love the heat. I just even when I have to wear a suit, it doesn't really bother me all that much. But it's a gorgeous day today. Gorgeous day. Hope everybody's had a good day up to this point. Looking forward to our conversation this afternoon, as always.
Yeah, love the heat, GJ. I love it.
Well, I know. Listen, I don't think you know what cold is anymore. Because every time that it's cold here, I see Facebook pictures of you somewhere with your bare feet in water on a beach.
I'm trying. I find the cheapest spot to go to.
I know. You're very good at it.
Yeah. Go there and just chill out for 3 months. Wait it out. And nobody misses me.
That's so, not true. Yeah. I mean, I certainly miss you.
Thanks, DJ.
I mean, it is always a pleasure when I get the heads up that you're going to be running the board, running the show. Not that I can't, I still have to be on my A game when Big Rob is my my partner, but I have to be on my A plus game. when you're on the board.
I look forward to this show. You being transparent and being available to the community, it's priceless. It's not everywhere that the prosecuting attorney, and I know if you're in the South, they call them state attorney, makes himself available. Because you could very well sit behind the desk, you know, and just put your feet up and just do what you do.
Sure.
But you chose. For how many years now? 10? Well,
it's good. It's 13 now.
13 years.
13. Yeah, 13 years.
And that is priceless. So if you can do that, I am honored to be here to ask you questions because it's always questions, right? There's always stuff going on.
Always questions.
Unfortunately, yes. There's always stuff going on.
Yeah, of course.
But you've done a good job of navigating. And I know recently you had the federal prosecutor here.
Yeah. We had the U.S. attorney for the Western District. We had a little press conference about a week ago that I know Big Rob had attended on behalf of the beat. And yeah, I mean, it was something that he actually called me and said, hey, would you be interested in doing something like this? And I said, sure. I mean, anytime I think that we can show the partnership between his office and my office, I think it's really important because a lot of times people don't understand that there are two separate, I mean, there's two separate sets of laws, even though they're somewhat similar in the sense that there's a federal code and there's a state code. I have the jurisdiction of the state code and Tim Verhey has the jurisdiction of the federal code when it comes to prosecution. But you know, a lot of language is similar and the crimes are the same. The systems are a little bit different in how things are done, both pre-charge, after charge, and then sentence-wise. You know, the federal system is a bit different. But, you know, again, what I've always appreciated, and Tim Verhey is the third U.S. attorney that I've had the pleasure of getting to know and working with in my tenure as the elected prosecutor. And each one has been always open to conversation, phone call, and ideas. Because I'm a big idea guy. A lot of times I don't think about the details. I like the big idea, and I've had the opportunity with all three of these guys in my career to have that meeting where I get to meet with them one on one with their staff and talk about kind of my vision of how I think the federal government, including federal law enforcement and federal prosecutions, can help make our community safer. And they've always been willing to listen. Now, I've been disappointed in sometimes the inaction that happens. But, you know, again, I try to appreciate and recognize that for me, buck stops with me, right? If I decide to do something, you know, I'm going to do it. Well, you know, with U.S. attorneys, this is true across the nation. Their boss is the attorney general. And so they've got to go through a series of red tape in order to get approval for something. I don't have to do that. Right. I don't have necessarily the same approval process. Right. And so I try to appreciate that. But, you know, I've had an opportunity now to meet with him. This is, I think, the third time he and I've been in the same room together. And what's different between him and the other two prior U.S. attorneys is that he is a career prosecutor. I mean, he's been in that office for over 30 years.
Oh, wow.
And for me, it's sort of similar to where my career path was, is that, you know, when you spend your entire career in an office that then you eventually get the opportunity to lead, you have been in the trenches, you have rolled up your sleeves, you know what it takes, and you know the relationships that you've built along that way that right. you carry with you, and now you're at a different level. And that to me is different. And that's nothing against Pat Miles, who I really like, and certainly nothing against oh, shoot. Now I'm going to forget his name.
Yeah, I remember him too. You brought him over.
Yeah, I did. I did. But
he was cold as ice.
Yeah. Those guys, they were appointed, but had really never, they for sure never career prosecutors.
Okay.
And so there is a difference, in my opinion. Right. And so, you know, when he called and said, is this something you'd be interested in? I said, absolutely. Let's do it. And then we worked through how we wanted it presented. And for me, it was making sure, again, the community understands that there is that partnership, which didn't just get formed last week. It's been formed over time. And ultimately, what we're interested in is making sure that people understand that there are two levels of consequences depending on the crime that you commit. I mean, it could be a state-level consequence or it could be a federal-level consequence. And what we're going to do as partners is look at where can we make the most impact? You know, and it doesn't necessarily mean who's going to get the, where system is this person going to get the most time in? Because as I indicated, I don't know if they used it or not. The media is that in the federal system, if you're sentenced, that doesn't mean that you're going to go to a federal prison in Michigan. You're available to go to a federal a prison anywhere in the United States.
Oh, wow.
I think that has a far more, that has a greater impact than whether you're doing, you know, 20 years or 10 years. If you're not going to be near, if you're not even going to be in your home state,
right?
I think that's a big deal.
Yeah, they might even send them down to Cuba. You never know. you never know.
I don't know what goes on with that. But.
You know, they got Tominal Bay, you know, down there.
Yeah.
I don't know who they hold in there, but it is a federal prison for America.
Yeah.
I just left Cuba a couple of weeks ago. They got that area locked down. You in another country, but that's all America over there. That whole area.
A
whole community of Americans. Wow, DJ. So much to discuss. I don't know if we want to get into the UMSAR cases first, but I know you had the helicopters. Was that you? Was you behind the helicopters over the weekend?
No, listen. I was not.
Did they fly over your house too?
No, they didn't fly over my house, but I was aware that they were going to be in town. And there was when we talk about federal state partnership, there was a joint federal state sort of operation happening Friday night. And that involved, before I left Friday afternoon, I was told the helicopter was, so I had no idea until Friday afternoon that it was going to be in there. And had I not run into somebody from the state police, I would have had no idea that helicopter was. Yeah, I mean, they don't tell me that kind of stuff. I mean, there's no need to tell me. I mean,
right, you'll hear about it. Guess
But they did have the helicopter in. And again, that was in to assist law enforcement. And my understanding was it was just relatively low-level street enforcement. I think they were helping us with some potential warrant pickups. In other words, people that had warrants out for their arrest. You know, and every once in a while, you know, we're able to gather the manpower in order to do that. Because it may surprise people, but when people have warrants for their arrest, they don't necessarily make themselves available or turn themselves in. I mean, they
stay out there.
They stay out there. Yeah. With the warrant hanging over their head. And so sometimes we're able to put together some resources with the sole purpose of, you know, just knocking on some doors, shaking some bushes a little bit and rounding up those folks that have warrants for their arrest.
Oh, so this is like a fugitive team out there. This week.
Yeah. I mean, it was, like I said, that was one of the purposes of what was happening over the weekend.
Okay. What you think it was successful?
I'm, you know, I know that at least from my standpoint and some of the things that I'm working on, yeah, that there were a couple of individuals that were apprehended that we had been looking for a minute. That was helpful. That was helpful.
Now the police department also has drones now, right? Big drones.
Yeah, a lot of departments do. I know the city of Muskegon does. I know the state police does. I think Norton Shores does as well. I'm not sure about Muskegon Heights. But what's interesting about those drones is that, you know, it's not like the drones that you go into Best Buy and pick up. Right. These are serious flying machines that actually you have to be trained at a federal level. I mean, you almost have to have a pilot's license to fly these things.
Okay.
So there, it's a specialty that you as a pilot are trained on. As we look at technology and what it has to offer, that is a nice enhancement. And mm-hmm. where I've actually personally had it used is crime scene photos. So for example, on a couple of traffic crashes that I worked on as the prosecutor, they would fly over and they would take pictures of the area mm-hmm. and an aerial view of, you know, the intersection or the street is a nice piece of evidence to look at. Right. And in particular, if you're looking at, you know, maybe debris pattern or skid marks or whatnot, it does help tell the story. And so on at least two occasions, I've had a drone that has taken crime scene photos for me.
Well, I think I've seen robots clear crime scenes too, go inside houses. Inside a house that, you know, you don't know if it's the person inside there or not.
Sure.
For safety purposes. Do we have that yet here in Muskegon?
I think the state police have robots. Typically, you'll see those with bomb squad. Right.
Yeah.
They'll roll up on a device. And again, it's, you know, like you indicated, it's far easier to replace a piece of machine than it is a human. And so it is for safety. But I'm almost positive that the state police and in their various posts have access to those types of robots. Whether our local departments do, I guess I don't know the answer to that question. I don't think so, but I don't know for sure.
Well, we got an online comment. Benita Thurgill says, family unfortunately serves the sentence as well. Travel, phone call fees, money for the family, all that. Speaking of the federal sentence.
Sure, for sure.
Yeah. We're live. If you have a question for DJ, 231-722-8338. We're also live on social media, on our Facebook page and on our YouTube page, 1037 to be YouTube. So, and our lines open. The phones is working today. I checked them out. Double checked. If you have a question or comment for DJ Hilson. So unsolved cases, I know there's plenty of them out there, and I know you didn't have enough time to try to get all of them. Of course, that'd be like a series.
Yeah.
Any ones particular that you can talk about today?
Well, you know, it's we were talking off air and you know, just so everybody knows, PA gave me a call yesterday and was indicating a couple of things. One, that he was going to be here today to do the show. And two, this was a topic he wanted to talk about. And if there was any that I wanted to mention, he was just kind of giving me a heads up. And what's interesting is unprompted, because I didn't speak to any detectives. Mm-hmm. I got an email this morning from one of the a city detective, basically outlining, hey, I know that you go on the beat
and
we'd like to, if you wouldn't mind, would you mention this particular case?
DJ, he don't tap my phone.
I'm not saying that Big Brother is listening.
I'm about to talk to T-Mobile.
but I mean.
Well, he tapped your phone.
You're
more important
than me.
You
know what? Look, there's probably cameras in my office. I have no idea. I'm being monitored 24/7.
That's right.
I think people recognize, and law enforcement recognizes, when it comes to, and we've talked about this many times on my show. Obviously, information is key. Information is power. It's what moves investigations forward. It's what helps us bring. I hate using the word closure because it doesn't really bring closure, but it helps us as investigators and law enforcement officials to get to the truth of what happened in a particular event. And then more importantly, then hold the folks that are the instigators of that event accountable. You know, that's our job. I mean, law enforcement's job is to investigate. My job is to hold offenders accountable. And that comes in a lot of different forms. But when we're talking about unsolved murder cases or unsolved violent incidences, I mean, that typically is going to bring a prison sentence if we can gather enough information and evidence to support a murder conviction. And so I think, you know, for a long time, law enforcement's always recognized how powerful media can be in that. And that's why you'll see often in cases that have been more difficult to solve, you'll see, you know, requests from the television, you know, making requests to television media to air a quick story and ask for information. That's why, you know, organizations like Silent Observer exist, because, you know, as I've said many times, at the end of the day, I don't really care whether you want to come to court or not. That's not important. What's important is information. You can provide that information very anonymously through Silent Observer. And as long as that information helps us move the ball forward, that's what's most important. We'll figure out the rest later. And so, you know, when cases sort of go stale, I mean, it's because the information has dried up. But as we were talking, as we had our conversation on the phone yesterday, I mean, it makes common sense. When something happens, people know what happened. Certainly the individual who's involved knows what happens.
Right.
Maybe there are folks that were with that individual that had no idea what was going to happen, but saw it happen.
Right.
You know, 9 times out of 10, that individual or individuals who are involved are talking to other people about what happened. And in this day and age, with cell phones and technology, they're texting, they're, you know, for whatever reason, people like to post stuff on social media,
right?
Which is great for law enforcement purposes. So, yeah, I mean, the information typically just doesn't wither at the moment that incident happens. It is alive and it's vibrant. And, you know, unfortunately, people that are in the know sometimes don't provide that information to the folks that can do something with that. And that's why media, in particular, this radio station and other outlets are so very important, because I think it's important that we remind people of these cases that are still open, that, you know, are potentially solvable if the right pieces of information come in, mm-hmm. that help us move the ball forward. And so, you know, again, I just appreciate the opportunity to use this platform to highlight a couple of cases that are at this point unsolved. The one that was emailed to me by the detective, and I apologize for you online folks to have to endure me putting my old man glasses on, but this was it's a couple of years old. It was January of 24. Our victim is an individual by the name of Janari Hawthorne. He was gunned down. And ultimately, law enforcement believes that, you know, there are some people of interest that they suspect might be involved, but just they don't have the information necessary in order to kind of push that ball forward. And so this is a case that we're hoping, by mentioning it and talking about it, will spur somebody to reach out to Silent Observer, which is 72 Crime, or if you're online, it's Muskegon Silent Observer .org, I think, or .net. And if you have a cell phone, you can download the Silent Observer app for Muskegon and submit tips that way. And again, I understand people are skeptical about using a computer, using a cell phone. I'm telling you right now, whether you call, whether you text, whether you send it via the web, it's entirely anonymous. And you should all know that, because usually when we talk about this, and it's Big Rob who sits on the committee, he's seen the process. He's seen how it works. He right. knows exactly what happens when somebody calls, texts, or sends it in via the web, and can confirm, in fact, it's entirely anonymous.
Wow.
And so, so that this was City of Muskegon, by the way.
That was January of 2024?
January of 2024.
Wow, two and a half years.
Yes.
That's a while.
It's a while. I mean, it's, you know, it's certainly not some of the older ones that we have, but, you know, again, from an investigation standpoint, you know, they always talk about the first 48 hours being the most critical, which is, I think, it really accurate. But, you know, certainly, again, with some of today's, with how things are today with technology, you know, I think we can expand that even to the next, you know, 72, 80, 86, you know, 3-4 days. But, you know, again, we have to know from a law enforcement perspective, we have to know what we're looking for. All right. I mean, I can't just randomly think, well, I mean, in this particular homicide, which was a drive-by, they must have driven by, you know, the Shell station. So let's just go pull video from the Shell station and see what we get. I mean, it just doesn't work that way. So, you know, ultimately, information is key. So, yeah, I mean, if there's anybody out there that has information on that particular homicide and wants to provide that to Silent Observer, I would absolutely ask and recommend that you do that. This is, again, for law enforcement and for myself, anytime a case is unsolved, it's unsettling. And, you know, I think what has really been, for me, what has been really satisfying is this idea that, you know, all our law enforcement partners, even though a case may not be to a point of issuing charges, they don't give up on it. They certainly react to any new information that comes in. Mm-hmm. And I have been blessed with a staff that carries that same passion and zeal. That it doesn't matter how old the case is, when fresh information comes, or if there's a point where we want to pull something off the shelf and give some fresh eyes to it and give it another shot, we're able to do that. Right. And doesn't mean that we're going to be successful, but it means that there is a passion and a drive to make sure that those families who have those questions that are unanswered, we do our best to try to answer those questions, regardless of how much time has passed.
Well, 231-722-8338. DJ, do you think sometime because of the cultural differences, the history of the Black community and the police has not been so great? Mm-hmm. No. I think it's better here in our community compared to other sure. communities. But there have been issues in the past. Do you think that might hinder progress in investigation sometime?
Oh, for sure. I mean, look, I've been doing this for a long time. And one of the most valuable lessons that I've learned in this part, this chapter of my career, is this idea that relationship building is really, really important. And again, you know, I think, as you indicated, I think law enforcement, in particular in our bigger cities, have really tried in the past to build that relationship. And, you know, some of my fondest memories, you know, I think about Muskegon Heights, and I think about, you know, Cliff Johnson when he was chief.
Oh yeah.
And he was so well respected in the community, and he knew everybody.
Right.
That, you know, it was just a matter of, you know, connecting the dots on the family tree, and he was going to find somebody who knew something or knew somebody.
And people would talk to him.
And people would talk to him. And that was because of who he was and the relationships that he built. And again, that's not to disparage anybody else or right. to say anybody else isn't doing the same. I mean, I look at the history of our largest department, which I think is the City of Muskegon, and some of the prior chiefs that worked hard on building community relationships. And it does go a long way, but we still sometimes run into these barriers of a distrust. And it could be because, you know, a family member or someone they knew has been through the system and they felt like that person was treated wrongly, whether that's right or wrong. I mean, that's their perception.
Yeah.
That plays a role in it. And of course, it's always this idea of well, I don't want to be seen talking to law enforcement because then people are going to label me as a rat, a snitch, whatever else. I mean, that's the one. I mean, certainly the relationship building is important, but that secondary one is the one that really bothers me in the sense that I try my best because I know that I am not in the same shoes of these folks. I understand that 100%. But I do know that as a community, there are more of the good law-abiding folks than there are of the folks that decide to skirt the law.
Right.
And once those folks unite as a group for that purpose, for good, they will be stronger than they think. And, you know, unfortunately, it's that unsettling fear in the back of your head. And I understand and appreciate that. But at the end of the day, one of the things that I always ask folks, and I try to put in my own perspective, that if it were something that had happened to my family, would I want somebody who had information to provide that, or would I be okay with them saying I'm just not comfortable because I'm afraid? And you know, I know where my feelings would be on that. And so, you know, it's easy to sit on the sidelines when maybe you're not directly or even indirectly involved, right? And it takes a lot of courage to step forward and do the right thing. And again, you know, that's why organizations like Silent Observer are so important. You can sort of get that weight off of your back, off your shoulders, off your chest, and do it in an anonymous way, allowing law enforcement then to take that information and go to the next step or next level.
Wow. So you mentioned that some of these people that commit crimes, they tell somebody. They generally tell somebody.
Yeah. I'm convinced of that.
You're convinced. And have you seen those somebody come forward in the past?
I have. Yeah. I mean, you know, some of the more interesting examples of that are, you know, we're talking about significant others. Usually it's girlfriends or wives. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite stories about that is we saw, this was back when I was an assistant, law enforcement, I should say, solved a murder. Was it a double murder? No, it was just a murder of a couple of dudes that broke into a house because the house they broke into at the time, because weed was illegal, he was a weed dealer, and they were there to steal his weed and I think steal the money too. And as a result, there was a struggle, and our guy, our homeowner, was killed. Two guys did that. And for the longest, for a while, we had a hard time with that one because, you know, it was hard to connect the dots. Well, one of the shooter, the guy I think that actually ended up pleading to first degree murder, if I remember correctly, told his girlfriend about what had happened in detail, and then decided to make her upset. And she came forward.
Oh, later on.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that ultimately led to charging not only him, but his accomplice that was in the house. And then we actually convicted the guy who set the whole thing up of first degree murder.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, it's things like that. That's why, you know, I am convinced that people talk because, again, you know, it's a hyped up, intense moment. And ultimately, it's hard to hold and contain that in. Because, you know, again, people are going to ask questions, and a lot of times people want to end up wanting to talk because in some respects they feel like that gives them some sort of credibility or street cred or whatever they're calling it these days. Uh-huh. But yeah, I mean, that's why I'm convinced in I'd say probably 99.9% of the incidents that there are people who may not have been directly involved in the incident, but have knowledge about what happened.
Well, I mentioned to you yesterday, I think, about a case in Roosevelt Park.
Yep.
At the hotel.
Yep.
I think her name was Faith. Nice young lady. I know she had about four or five kids. And it's been probably, what, maybe a decade, Maura?
Yeah, I was trying to remember what year that happened, and I can't remember if I was an assistant or if I was the elected. I might have been an assistant.
I think you were assistant.
Yeah, I think it goes back that far. Again, it's one of those cases where you know, information is key. Information is power, and you know, we always. I mean, that's why doing shows like this are important, because it kind of brings to the forefront these cases that have been, you know, when you sit back and you go, holy cats, that was that long ago. You don't realize how quickly time flies. And so, you know, ultimately, if there are people out there with information on that particular case, I'd be very interested in hearing it and knowing it, so that we can reopen those case files and maybe take a fresh look at it and work towards an end.
Wow. What is considered like a cold file? What do you consider a cold file?
Well, I mean, I think everybody's got their own definition of it. I mean, certainly any case that isn't charged that's happened, any crime or any case that isn't charged is cold. And it, you know, it becomes I don't think there's a period of time that defines a cold case. I mean, a lot of times you'll see people call cold cases and they're, you know, 15, 20, 30 years old. Mm-hmm. And that's appropriate. But, you know, quite honestly, a case that goes and goes uncharged for a month is a cold case. Okay. Right. I mean, because it isn't charged. And so that's how I look at it. They just don't get the same kind of attention because, again, I think in some people's minds, you got to have all this time pass for it to be a cold case. And I disagree with that. I think quite to the contrary. It is anytime a case is I guess chargeable or has the potential to be charged and isn't, because we just don't have all the information necessary, it's a cold case.
Wow. Have you been able to create a profile of killers, people who have had a history of killing?
Well, I think we have, I think based off of our major crimes unit that got established back in 2013, and the level of intelligence they've been able to put together through time and looking at, again, with some forensic technology, being able to match not I will say guns to various either fatal or non-fatal shootings, and coupling that with basic intel, I think we've been able to establish folks that we believe to be shooters. A lot of those shooters had been convicted of crimes and have been taken off the street. But yeah, I mean, I think we have an idea of who our potential shooters are. Not, and it's just a matter of being able to put together enough evidence that would push us to be able to prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt. I mean, one of the great things that we employ, and when I say we, I'm talking law enforcement in my office, is sometimes as we work towards getting that information for the bigger case, we're able to charge and convict somebody who we believe to be a main person of interest in those bigger cases with something else. Hmm. So even though we may not be it may not be ripe to charge them with something, the larger incident, if we build up enough smaller incidents, we can pull them off the street for a period of time at a minimum, give us some space to start really hoping to get information on the larger event. In the same token, directly or indirectly, taking what we believe to be somebody who has a prone to violence off the street.
Right, right. If you can go back maybe a couple of decades, how many murders do you believe we have that's in the community?
Oh, how many murderers?
Unsolved murders.
Unsolved murders?
You know, somebody has done these crimes and they probably live in here or maybe died.
Yeah, I mean, off the top of my head, I couldn't even guess at that.
You think it's over a dozen?
I have no idea. Yeah, I mean, I'd have to go back and look and see how many unsolved cases through the year, because we keep track of all those cases, and you know what we have been able to do over time because of, you know, some of the efforts of law enforcement, and I have to give community a lot of props because we do tend to receive good information from individuals in the community that are what we call our clearance rate. So that when a crime happens, being able to charge and prosecute and clear it has been pretty high. I mean, we've been in the upper 90s, and I think one year we were at 100%. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know off the top of my head to really properly answer your question. I can say prospectively, we've been doing a really good job of making sure that we end up getting to the point of being able to charge somebody and hold them accountable for that.
Right. Is the investigation component your responsibility or the local police department?
Well, I you know, certainly we, as prosecutors, we do not investigate. That is law enforcement's responsibility. Now, that's not to say that we don't assist in investigations. And certainly, I'd like to think that we're co-partners in an investigation, because ultimately, whatever information and evidence is that is gathered in an investigation, we ultimately have to use that information and evidence in the prosecution. And so it makes sense that we would work hand in hand in some of the larger cases, because we want to make sure from our trial experience, where we know what jurors' thought patterns are, or how, you know, particular officers were cross-examined on, you know, what they did or didn't do in an investigation, helping and assist law enforcement to avoid those pitfalls. Now, we do have at our disposal by Michigan law some things that allow the prosecutor to take a little bit more active role in investigation. We've used on many occasions and are actively using it now in some investigations, the investigative subpoena process. And that allows us to petition the court. It's similar to a search warrant, where we petition the court, laying out the facts and circumstances as to why we believe a crime occurred and why we believe the list of individuals that we wish to question under oath is necessary. So a judge has to review all that and make a determination. One, there's enough to show that a crime was committed. And then there's enough to show that the individuals listed in that, I'll say, witness list are people that may have either indirect or direct knowledge about that particular crime. That has been very, that's been an extremely successful process for us, because two reasons. One, it's completely secret. You know, when somebody comes in under subpoena, we let them know what said in that room until the case is charged is secret. The fact that they're there is secret. They can't tell anybody they're there. We can't tell anybody that they were there. What was said can't be told. And so that's a pretty nice protection. The other thing is that they're sworn. So it's like when you go to court and you take an oath to tell the truth and nothing but the truth.
Right.
You take the same oath when you're under investigative subpoena, so that if in fact you commit perjury under investigative subpoena, that in and of itself is a separate crime.
Right.
And a lot of times, you know, whether it be persons of interest or persons with knowledge, will not tell the truth. And then we ultimately use our discretion and that ability to make sure that people understand that what we're interested in is not to necessarily make them an involved actor in this, but is to get to the truth. And it's in their best interest. And what we have found is, certainly working with the public defender's office and then people retain lawyers, working with a lawyer is far easier in this process.
Okay.
Than trying to deal with somebody who's unrepresented. And obviously, whether they come into the investigative subpoena process unrepresented or if they face a criminal charge as a result of their misinformation, lawyers get involved, and then we are able to make everybody understand and appreciate this is what we're looking for. All we want is the truth. And we know that you can get us there.
Right. Wow. Any other case you want to discuss?
Well, I mean, the other one too, that in talking with my folks is it's relatively recent, February of this year. So February of 26, it was, I think it's Tavon Watson, 15-year-old young man.
Wow.
He was sitting in the backseat of a car with two other individuals, and there was a drive-by between that car and the suspect car, and unfortunately, Mr. Watson lost his life as a result. We certainly don't believe that he was the intended target. He was just at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Wow.
But that occurred in the city of Muskegon Heights in an alley between 6th and 7th Street near Hume.
6th and 7th Street. Okay. Yeah.
And again, you know, from a time sense, this is February of 26, but we're in July. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're 5 months removed from that incident, and we're not close enough to make any charging decisions. And so to me, it's the ones that are closer in time that where the information is probably right. still very, very fresh.
Right.
And just, so
well, I don't know. I assumed that case had been solved. No, as a kid.
No.
Like,
I know. You'd think I would hope that would be a motivating factor.
Right.
Right. Right. That, you know, we're in a day and age right now where a lot of our young people are really struggling, mm-hmm. For a lot of different reasons. And, you know, as I think I've indicated more than once on my show, you know, we're seeing our offenders get younger and younger, and we're seeing our victims get younger and younger. And this is a prime example. And if there was anything that was going to motivate somebody to step forward and say, hey, listen, I have some information and I want to give it to you, I would think that the loss of a young life,
right.
not that any the loss of any life is any more tragic or less tragic than anybody else, but a 15-year-old young man,
right,
who, you know, again, had nothing to do with the circumstance, lost his life.
Lost his life. Did it happen in the daytime?
No, this was a nighttime event, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay. And this is, you said February?
February of 26.
February yep. of 2026, five months ago. And are they close? Not even close?
You know, from what I remember from the initial investigation, you know, there were a lot of conversations, in particular with the individuals that were in the car with our deceased young man. And, you know, I can say that the information provided didn't get us anywhere closer to being able to make a charging decision.
Do you believe that the folks in the car probably knew who the other people might be?
I have this, whether it's naive or not, I always have this sense that, especially when we're dealing with the small pocket of, turf war, whatever you want to call it, that individuals know who their friends are and they know who their enemies are.
Okay.
Right? And, you know, people do everything they can to sometimes wear masks and all that other stuff, but, you know, cars look familiar. Maybe some clothing looks familiar. A way a person's eyes look can right. be very familiar. You know, even if you're sort of kind of speculating a little bit, that's still important information. It helps us at least eliminate, let's say, somebody who may not be necessarily involved, but now we can put that to rest because right. we've done our due diligence there, and that's not the direction we need to go. We need to go in a different direction.
Wow. And so that information didn't get you anywhere.
No.
Well, and it's probably a short list of people that, I mean, people know who don't like them. I mean, like,
for sure,
probably want to kill them. That's very.
I would hope that was a short list.
Yeah, yeah. You would think that's a short list. And 5 months later, we don't have arrests in a city so small.
Right.
Do you think the perpetrators were from this area?
Oh, for sure.
They're from here.
Oh, I'm convinced that they are. I don't think this is a outside in type of deal. It's pretty rare that happens. We've had it happen on a couple of occasions, mm-hmm. but it's pretty rare that happens.
So someone in Muskegon is responsible for the murder of this 15-year-old kid who had nothing to do with a beef between other folks.
As far as we know, it had nothing to do with it. It was in the backseat of a car. That's it.
Wow. Well, you got any questions for DJ? 231-722-8338. Muskegon, what do you think? You know, what do you think about, you know, solving homicides? Because we hear the rhetoric sometime when a homicide might occur in the suburbs and it's solved. Some people would say, oh, they solved that quick. But it's a reason why they were able to solve that quick. Right, DJ?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, it has absolutely nothing to do with the parties involved in the location. It has everything to do with the information that's available to law enforcement at the time that they are able to respond and start investigating. And again, that's what drives everything. So if law enforcement arrives, and let's just say there are survivors, right, that can say, this is what happened, this is who came up, this is who pulled the trigger, and this is who they were with, we can work a lot faster with that information than I didn't see what happened, I don't know, and you know, all the other excuses that happen. And so, yeah, I mean, it again, law enforcement doesn't care about, you know, whether you're male or female, whether you're purple or you're green, it doesn't matter. Their job, and they've taken an oath, a duty to serve and protect, and they are just as interested in getting to the truth and getting the perpetrators off the street as the people who are either indirectly or directly involved. I can guarantee you that. And if they're not interested, which that isn't true, I'm absolutely interested in that. That has always been, for me, a driving force in a lot of what I do. Not only, you know, from a reactive side of things and getting to the truth, but also on a proactive side of things is getting to a point where we don't have to worry about whether or not we have to get to the truth because the crime doesn't happen. And so, yeah, I mean, that has been a fire in me probably since the first day I walked into the Muskegon County Prosecutor's Office back in 1999.
Right, right. Well, just reading about the case, this, you know, 15-year-old kid, you know, in school, people liked him. You know, appears to be a nice young man, nothing to do with this, and innocently is taken away, and we can't even get the killer off the street in Muskegon. Like, somebody, we're a small community, though. Like, somebody knows somebody.
Yep.
We know that. And that's what bothers me, that we, that where's our conscience at? You know, how can you sleep?
Yeah.
Knowing that you know someone has taken a life of someone. But if your family is a victim, you want the police to could kind of miraculously solve things. You know, it's like,
yeah,
put yourself in that young man's mother's, you know, position right now. And it just seems unfair, you know. And it is, honestly, if it happens in Norton Shores, the coach out there is going to be like, we tell him, you know.
Yeah.
We call in the police. We're going to tell who done it. And then, but it happens in our community, crickets. Not all the time, because I mean, Chief Sane has told me that he's seen some cases where people have stepped up.
You know? Well, and again, I do think that there's been a big improvement in that. And my hat always goes off to those members of the community that say, you know, enough is enough, and I gotta do something. And so I can't say that it's 100%, you know, barrier that we face, but you know, there's always room for improvement.
We're going to the phone line. Caller, you have a question, comment for DJ Hilson?
Yes. Hi. Hi, DJ.
Hey.
Prosecuted Pamela Harvey and my brother-in-law, who got stabbed 188 times.
Yep.
Curtis.
Yep.
And your team did a wonderful job. But I have a question for you.
Yeah.
My son is incarcerated right now.
Okay.
And I was wondering why Michigan doesn't have good time.
Well, is he incarcerated in jail or in prison?
No, he's in prison. But like if he would have got sentenced for the same crime in, say, like a state that has good time, he would only do half the time.
Well, you know
why doesn't Michigan have good time for, like, say if you get 10 years, you know, like in most states, if you get 10 years, you serve six, you know.
Yeah, Michigan has what's called truth in sentencing. So I know exactly what you're talking about. So truth in sentencing has been on the books.
Snyder, I think, under Snyder years.
Even before that.
Before Snyder.
Oh, before that.
When I worked at the prison, we had good time.
Yeah. It's been in place for a while. I'm trying to think, maybe 88, 89, 90. Is what's coming to my head. But anyways, what truth in sentencing means is that when somebody is sentenced to prison, now jail is different. There is good time in jail. I think it's every 5 days you serve, you get 1 day of good time. That's state law. But in prison, under truth in sentencing, if you, let's say you're sentenced to 2 years in the Michigan Department of Corrections, you're going to do that entire two before you see the parole board. And, you know, I appreciate what you're saying and what you're asking. And certainly there have been movements, even as recently as when I was president of our association, where people were trying to find a way to bring some of that, I'll say, good time ideas back, and it's never really gained any traction in the legislature. And I will say, in all transparency, I mean, my association is staunchly against it, because you have to appreciate, as we look at both sides of the coin on this, when we're having conversations with victims or victims' families, and we're talking about, one of the things they always ask is, well, how much time are they going to do? And we can say with confidence, you know, here's the guideline range. Here's what the judge has to work with. And so, you know, they could sentence anywhere within here, but understand that whatever that first, there we go. I hit my microphone. I apologize. Whatever that first number is, that's the number they're going to do before they see the parole board. And so there's some certainty. There's certainty for victims and victims' families, and there's certainty for the defendant, who knows this is the time I'm going to do. Right. The problem is, what in even in those states that you're talking about,
right,
what happens is that the system finds a way to adjust. So to your point, if somebody gets, let's say hypothetically, somebody gets a 10-year sentence, but because of good time, they're going to serve six. Well, if I want that person to serve 10, now their first number isn't going to be 10 anymore. It's going to be 15. You understand what I'm saying? And so there'll be an adjustment there. And I don't know that that's necessarily fair on either side, because it creates that uncertainty. And that's, you know, in essence, that's sort of my basic example in answer to that question. I mean, I totally understand it. And for some inmates, and maybe, you know, your brothers in this camp, if they truly wanted,
your son.
If you truly want to reform and you have that in your heart, then yeah, something like good time is good, because that's a motivation for you to really do what you need to do in order to change your behavior, change your thinking, whatever it is, right? And unfortunately, there are people out there that are ready to do that. Of course, there are people out there that aren't ready to do that, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's that crazy balance of, again, trying to hold people accountable, in the same time trying to send a deterrent message. And, you know, we can have the debate about whether incarceration fits into that model or not, and all that stuff. But yeah, I mean, in the end, I understand what you're saying. And having been part of those conversations with the special interest groups, I understand.
Maybe good time would even be like pertaining to nonviolent crimes or something.
Sure, yeah. Sure, right. I mean, yeah, you could bifurcate it that way. Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of ways to look at this. And like I indicated, right, there have been efforts to engage in those conversations. And right, I don't even know if our legislators as a whole are ready to take that task on. You know, and that's the ugly side of politics, which is a whole nother conversation.
Right. Thanks. Okay. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you for answering. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for the call.
All right.
231-722-8338. Got time for one more call. Lewis Churchwell said truth and sentencing came in with Governor Engler.
Okay. Lewis Churchwell. Yeah, yeah. You can always
rely. You know, Lewis knows. Oh, our board member right there.
Yeah. Thanks, Lewis, for saving me. I appreciate it.
Steve Jones said, most people don't get involved until crimes hit their doors. At that point, police become their best friends.
Well, there's a reason why people call 911, right?
Right. Right.
There's a reason why people do that. I mean, I would. I'd call 911.
You know, I just think about it. I'm always referencing my village in Africa,
yeah,
and how they deal with crime. There's no way they're going to allow a killer to stay in my village. If somebody molests a kid in our village, they're going to get beat down. And if they survive that, they're going to be ostracized from the village, mm-hmm, you know, and they're going to get penalized according to African traditions.
Sure.
And it's not, they might not go to the police, DJ. I would say that,
mm-hmm,
but they will be punished so badly that they would never commit that crime again.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they held responsible, you know, and just the fact that we are accountable with not everybody, that there are people that are comfortable with knowing that we have, you know, a killer in our community, killers in our community, and you know these individuals and you know about the crime and you know there are people who are hurting from these crimes, and you want people to be sympathetic to your pain and you're not sympathetic to their pain. I don't get it. Andrea Robinson said, my son was murdered and I feel this, the heist did a poor job of investigating his murder. Andrea, can you call in? 231-722-8330. We got like 2 minutes left. Less like actually 90 seconds. Yeah, I'm looking at the time. Yeah, it's time to go.
Well, you know, as is always, I mean, it's always amazing to me how when I sit down and like, okay, we're going to be here for an hour. In 5 minutes, it's like, where did that hour go?
We're done.
You know, again, it's, you know, get, what I love about this is that there's outside of the phone call every once in a while, there's no pre-production meeting. We really don't, we don't come in with a set outline and agenda. Like in the first 30 minutes, we're going to talk about this.
Oh, no.
It's which is what I love, man. Free flowing conversation is what it's all about.
Right.
And that's the way it should be. Unscripted and everything else.
And to Andrea Robinson, I hope you don't give up.
Don't give up.
Yeah. If you don't feel like the Hikes is doing their job, please talk to.
Call me.
Call the DJ. Talk to Mosane.
Yep.
Don't give up. You know, call us. We're here to put this information out to the community. And those people can be held responsible. You know, one thing we learned for the Telfreda Covington case,
mm-hmm.
that your department did a great job, DJ, after, 30 plus years?
Yeah.
That the person that is accused of killing her had killed before.
Yep.
You know? And so, you know, we can save lives. We can save other people's lives by coming forward. And all right, I'll let you do your closing. It's your show.
No, listen. It's not. I mean, I appreciate it. You think it's my show, but it's really not. No, hey, listen, obviously great conversation. I think it's really important. And we highlighted a couple of cases, but I know there are many more out there. And certainly, if you are a family member of a cold case or a case that hasn't been charged yet, you know, don't let people forget. Don't let people forget. And I stand by this idea that there are folks out there in all these cold cases that have knowledge. And I know that only because as these cases become solved and charged, you hear about people coming forward and talking about something that they've held on to for, you know, 5 months, 6 years, whatever it is. And so ultimately, you know, don't give up. Understand that in Muskegon County, my office is ready, willing, and able to assist law enforcement in any new information that comes forward and getting to the truth and holding those accountable. That is our goal. That is our mission. That is our passion. Other than that, enjoy today. Enjoy the rest of the week. Enjoy summer. And God bless you, Muskegon. You guys are awesome.